Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been more than three decades since America built a nuclear reactor. But construction on a whole lot more may be coming, and relatively soon. This week, President Obama was unequivocal. More reactors, he said, are a crucial step toward realizing a low-carbon future.
We're going to have to build a new generation of safe, clean nuclear power plants in America.
Safe and clean are good goals, but what to do with nuclear waste is still a devilish problem, not to mention very real concerns over leaks, most recently in Vermont. This hour on Point, the debate over more nuclear. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to see more nuclear reactors? Is this a necessary part of a low-carbon future? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Power, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He covers energy and environmental issues. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Explain the significance, would you, of the president's announcement this week regarding nuclear power?
Sure. Well, this is part of President Obama's broader strategy of building support for legislation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And what he's specifically trying to do here is build some support among Republicans, who are tend to be big supporters of nuclear power, as well as among organized labor, which stands to gain from new manufacturing jobs that could come about if there is a resurgence in nuclear power. And his announcement this week of loan guarantees for the Southern Company to build some new nuclear reactors in the state of Georgia is one of several things he's done recently. He earlier this month also presented a budget proposal for the fiscal year 2011 that begins in October that calls for tripling federal support tripling the amount of money that the federal government can guarantee in loans to companies that want to build nuclear reactors. So he is trying to reach out to Republicans in the hopes that this will increase their willingness to support his agenda on climate change.
So despite the $8.3 billion in loan guarantees, the nuclear reactors proposed for Georgia are far from a done deal.
That's correct.
What are the next steps in this ongoing process?
The design still has to be approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and that's going to take some time. That's the major thing that has to happen for this project to become a reality.
What's been the response to all this from the nuclear industry and environmental groups?
The nuclear industry is, as you can imagine, very pleased both with the announcement of this these loan guarantees, as well as with President Obama's proposal to greatly expand the loan guarantee program at the Department of Energy. The industry has estimated that the president's proposal would support the construction of 7 to 10 new reactors or new facilities. The Republicans so far are pleased with the president's announcement to both expand the loan guarantee program and to make these awards. But a number of Republicans, including Senator McCain, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, have also said that this is not going to be enough to persuade them to support the sort of a broad economy-wide bill that that President Obama is urging Congress to pass. They have many other objections, many other concerns about the legislation, and don't seem inclined yet to be willing to support such legislation based on this program. It's important to remember that this loan guarantee program was actually created by Congress in 2005 through a 2005 energy law, and it took a number of years under both the Bush administration and now the Obama administration for administration officials to determine what would be the risk for the federal government to go along and support these projects. What would be the risk to taxpayers? The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the default risk with nuclear reactors could be well in excess of 50%. So there's a lot of difficult questions here. These instruments are these types of decisions are very complicated, and so there had been some grumbling from Republicans that it had taken both administrations too long to make decisions.
So you mentioned this is a complicated issue, and with the Republican opposition that you mentioned, what are the chances that this nuclear power project might actually happen?
With regard to the Southern Company project, that's really going to be in the hands of the NRC, and I think it's a little too early to tell what the NRC is going to do. I think the Southern Company, they appeared to be very confident that they've got a good design here. In the case of the loan guarantee program, I think that the president's proposal has a pretty good chance of happening based just because on the fact that the response from Democrats and even some liberal Democrats who have tended to be opponents of nuclear power has been relatively subdued. Mm-hmm. You have seen a lot of opposition from various environmental groups, but broadly speaking, many of the leading environmental groups are so eager to get a cap on carbon emissions that they've tended to be somewhat restrained and to have gone along with these concessions. They're not happy about it. They've definitely been expressing their dissatisfaction. But it's been an interesting contrast. Last year, there was a similar proposal by a Republican from Utah named Robert Bennett, who proposed to also greatly expand the loan guarantee authority for nuclear power at the Department of Energy and to put it in legislation that was moving through Congress. He came under enormous attack from environmental groups who ran ads in his state, attacking him. And it was beaten back. You don't see environmental groups doing that to President Obama, and I think that that's a reflection of the fact that the environmental groups, they very much do want, as much as a lot of environmental groups have concerns about nuclear power, they really want a bill on climate change.
Well, it's good information. Stephen Power, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Power is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joins me from Washington. We have two experts with us this hour to focus in on the future of American nuclear power. From Washington, Edwin Lyman, senior scientist and physicist for global security for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's the former president of the Nuclear Control Institute, and he's testified before Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Ed, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And from the studios at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Paul Wilson, professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. He chairs the Energy Analysis and Policy Program of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Paul, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Before we get into the details here, I'm curious what your positions are on the president's initiatives. Edwin Lyman, you first.
Well, the administration has said that it's their goal to restart the nuclear industry in the United States, and we have a lot of concerns about that. We don't know if U.S. taxpayers actually understand what they're being, what they're supposed to be underwriting here. The administration wants to put tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money at risk for a technology which we think still has significant safety, security, waste and nonproliferation concerns. With regard to safety, it looks like the generation of plants that is being proposed is not going to be any safer than the current generation. And to highlight the AP1000, which is the design that Southern Company has proposed to build, is experiencing a great deal of difficulty right now in working out some of the design issues.
Paul Wilson, let me just step in and have Paul jump in here with your headline position on the president's initiatives.
Well, I think this is part of the president's broader approach to look at our energy policy. We've had a lack of energy policy largely in this country for a long time, and I think he recognizes the way most Americans and many in Congress recognize that nuclear energy is an important part of that approach. And so this is one measure. I don't think it's fair to say the administration's sort of a giddy supporter of nuclear energy. I think this is a well-measured approach, and he's looking for ways to provide the stimulus where it can help, but taking a broad approach.
Here's President Obama speaking from a jobs training center for energy in Maryland on Tuesday. He said that the United States must move forward with nuclear power. And in that speech, he proposed these $8 billion in loan guarantees to build these twin reactors in Georgia. Obama said it was necessary. It was a necessary part of achieving a clean energy future.
The fact is, even though we've not broken ground on a new power plant, new nuclear power plant in 30 years, nuclear energy remains our largest source of fuel that produces no carbon emissions to meet our growing energy needs and prevent the worst consequences of climate change. We'll need to increase our supply of nuclear power. It's that simple. This one plant, for example, will cut carbon pollution by 16 million tons each year when compared to a similar coal plant.
So, Ed Lyman, senior scientist, global security of union and concerned scientist, do you accept that nuclear power is a necessary part of addressing the broader issue of climate change?
No, we don't. I'd like to say that our organization is not categorically opposed to nuclear power. We do accept that it could play some role in future energy supply, but it is it has its own set of problems. And we think those problems have to be fully accounted for before we can consider expanding nuclear power. Our organization has done analysis which shows that at least till 2030, we don't need to greatly expand the amount of nuclear power in order to mitigate carbon emissions. In fact, nuclear power appears to be one of the most expensive options for doing that. So it's really a matter of government policy and whether or not the American public thinks it's appropriate to actually expand nuclear power, and they need to be fully informed of the risk before I think they can make that decision.
And what do you think, Paul Wilson? Is it a necessary part of addressing climate change?
I think it is. I think if we want to take a vigorous approach, which many people in the country are interested in, I think nuclear power is an important part. I agree it's not the cheapest first choice. Energy efficiency, I think, was a broad agreement that we need more work in energy efficiency and other programs. However, nuclear energy falls pretty quickly in behind there, as you really try to have a dramatic decrease in your carbon emissions. If you're going to take a slow road, then maybe there's more room to move without nuclear energy. But if you really want to have an important role in climate change, nuclear energy has to be part of the picture.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the big push for more nuclear power in America. Edward Lyman joins me from Washington this hour. He's senior scientist and physicist for global security for the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Paul Wilson joins me from Madison, Wisconsin. He's professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Let me get right to one of the big issues here that's associated with nuclear power, and that is safety. Paul Wilson, what are the safety risks to your mind attached to nuclear power?
So nuclear energy has had an improving safety record for decades now, and I think the concerns people have about nuclear safety have largely been put to rest. We have a strong nuclear regulator. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is one of the most trusted regulators in the country, and we have organizations like the Union of Concerned Scientists that I think play a very important role in being the external sort of oversight and keeping that regulator honest, and that's one of the reasons for its success. And so I think that the design process, the operations have all gotten safer. The nuclear energy industry is one of the safest industries, if not the safest industry in the country from all kinds of measures. We see the performance improving continuously, the safety performance as well as the economic performance. And we see that the workplace is one of the safest places to be a worker in the country, too.
So, Edwin Lyman, what do you think? When you think about safety issues, of course, Three Mile Island comes immediately to mind. But do you agree with Paul? I mean, have safety concerns been put to rest? Has the nuclear industry's safety record improved since Three Mile Island?
I'd say overall there's been slight improvement, but there are still significant problems. What I worry about is the risk of the catastrophic accident. And the fact is that there still is the possibility of a Chernobyl-type loss of containment and large radiological release in this country. The actual industry estimate would be, using industry's figures, almost 1% a year that there would actually be a Three Mile Island type event in this country, and about a possibly 10% risk that would actually lead to a large radiological release, which could affect potentially hundreds of thousands of people, leading to tens or hundreds of early fatalities from radiation syndrome and tens or hundreds of thousands of cancer deaths. That is the risk that we have to keep in mind. And what I worry about most is security. The fact is that infrastructure is still at risk in the United States, as recent events have demonstrated. And a terrorist group that knows a little bit about how nuclear reactors work can figure out a way to actually induce a Chernobyl-type accident.
What about that security, Paul? Let me ask you about that. The fuel cycle required to support nuclear power does overlap with the capabilities needed to build nuclear weapons. Is that an insignificant concern here in the United States?
I think in the United States, we've established a separation between our military and our civilian nuclear energy industry. And so I think the security concern has many facets. In terms of proliferation of nuclear weapons, I think that's one issue that isn't an issue for domestic nuclear energy, for the obvious reason that the United States is a nuclear weapons country. However, for the terrorist issue, I think we do need to make sure and be ever vigilant, as we are, that we're responding to that threat. And through the oversight of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they just recently, just yesterday, released a report that they think that all of the nuclear operators are substantially secure and are able to respond to the threats that they've been asked to respond to.
Let me get some callers in here who'd love to join this conversation. Maquoketa, Iowa, is where we're going first. Ray is on the line. Hi, Ray. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, this is Ray from Maquoketa.
Mm-hmm.
And I work in the industry that builds these power plants and maintains them. And I see a lot of, you know, possibilities here for a lot of good-paying jobs. And good-paying jobs are where the tax money's at. That's part of the recovery process to bring in good-paying jobs, and these plants are crucial to that. I can't see any reason not to build them. I mean, security concerns are, as far as I'm concerned, nil. There's a lot of background check going involved just to work in one of these places. And then safety concerns, as was already mentioned, they're one of the safest places in the world to work. I don't see, you know, I mean, sure, people can look at that side of it and be concerned about it if they want to, but I think the chances are just as good as getting struck by lightning as having a terrorists get into all those places. You can't even get an American citizen in there without a 5-year background check.
So you see that they're safe, and you see job creation with nuclear power. Ray, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here's Jerry from Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi.
Hello.
In the land of the Yankee nuclear plant, we're having a lot of problems.
Yes.
Anyway, having said that, I lived in Saudi Arabia, and when I left in 1983, they were putting out a gazillion solar panels. At least you see the recycling of the money they're making. They're making enough solar panels to light all of Europe. Now, what are we doing? What are we doing? Where are we going to put this waste? Even the Aborigines don't want it in Australia, and Nevada certainly doesn't want it. So to me, it is totally irresponsible to even think about putting up plants when we have people that don't even know how to balance their checkbook. To me, this is unconscionable.
I thank you very much for your call. There are a lot of issues raised by Jerry in his call. Waste is one of them. We'll get to it. But he calls from Vermont, and I'd like to go back to the Yankee nuclear plant that he mentioned at the beginning of his call. There have been tritium leaks at the Yankee power plant in Vermont just recently. How significant were those leaks, Edwin?
I'm sorry, that's for me?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think what's going on at Vermont Yankee and many other plants around the country is a troubling indication of how much uncertainty there still is at nuclear facilities that have been around for decades. The fact is that Yankee operators claim they didn't even know that they had buried underground pipes that were carrying radioactive coolant that are now suspected to be the source of the tritium leaks. So the fact is that if they didn't know the existence of pipes, how can we really trust that they know some of the other or have a good handle on some of the other uncertainties associated with plant operations?
So
I see the tritium leaks as a very troubling harbinger of trouble to come unless there's a very stringent crackdown.
Paul Wilson, what do you think? When you hear terms like leak and tritium and groundwater, you put those words together in a single sentence, a lot of people get a little nervous. Do these mishaps, like the one we saw at the Yankee nuclear plant in Vermont, do they undermine confidence in other reactors that might go up around the country?
Well, I think when people read the headlines, the confidence may be undermined. However, we do see the Nuclear Regulatory Commission moving to respond quickly to these. I'm going to keep coming back to the fact that we have such a strong and effective regulator. But also, if you look at the science of what's going on here, we've had a few situations with these tritium leaks, and in most cases, all up to this Vermont case so far, which is still under investigation, the levels have been found to be below those that have been established by the EPA and the NRC as being health concerns. And so we need to separate. It's important in these conversations to separate the public health, the real public health risk, the real public health impact, I should say, from the headlines that we read. And I think in these cases with the tritium releases, we do need to use them as a sign that we need to be things that we should be making sure we're taking good care of, like we do every day, but we also need to to separate what the real impact is from what we see in the headlines.
Here's another call from Boston. Keith is on the line. Hi, Keith. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. There seems to be a fair amount of discussion within the nuclear industry about the element thorium rather than uranium, which mitigates proliferation concerns and also significantly reduces waste, yet the public seems to know nothing about it. I was hoping your experts could talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. What about thorium? Paul Wilson?
Yeah, Jane, thorium is an interesting alternative. It's being pursued heavily by India because they have a lot of it. My analysis, I've been trying to study this for the last few years, and I don't see that the benefits, particularly to our industry and our infrastructure, are really as large as many of the proponents would say. If you want to get into a full use of the thorium cycle, you're going to need reprocessing technology, which is going to look very similar to reprocessing technology we should be having for our conventional fuel cycle. And so I don't see the benefits being substantial. There are small benefits here and there, but I don't see there being a real reason to drive heavily towards thorium.
What about the issue of waste that Jerry brings up and the last caller mentioned as well? Talk about the issue of waste disposal as it relates to nuclear power. And Paul Wilson, described for us where and how all this spent fuel is stored currently in the United States.
Right. So spent nuclear fuel is a fascinating topic to me. Right now, we have about 65 sites around the country that have nuclear power plants, and all the spent nuclear fuel generated at those sites is still stored at those sites. The total quantity of spent nuclear fuel is really not very large, and it's very important, I think, for your listeners to understand just what we're talking about, that all of the spent nuclear fuel from the whole country, from all the years of generating nuclear energy, would fit into a typical football stadium 10 or 12 feet high. On top of that, another way to think of it is if you were to live for 80 years and get all of your electricity supplied by nuclear energy, your lifetime contribution would be the size of a soda can. So the amount of waste, it's really important to put that into perspective, especially when you compare to the waste streams from other energy sources. How do we take care of it? Right now, the majority of that waste is stored in pools of water that are underground, protected inside the reactor building. In some reactors, they're taking some of that waste out and putting it in heavily fortified canisters above ground.
And it's solid, right? Is that right?
It's solid. I like to sort of remind people it's a ceramic. It's like the dishes you eat off of. If you were to drop one of those, even if it broke, it would sit on the ground until you swept it up and put it in the garbage, moved it away. And so there's not people have this image, I think, of nuclear waste as something that is going to ooze through the cracks and get under their door. But spent nuclear fuel is really very secure. It's a solid material. It's encased in metal. That's further encased in different types of protecting canisters. And so even whether you're shipping it or keeping it put, it's got all these different layers that are going to keep it put.
And yet there are longstanding disputes over where to put this, secure away. So Edwin Lyman, let me bring you in and ask you about this longstanding dispute over Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Remind us where that stands and what that issue is about.
Okay, well, first I'd just like to respond briefly to if you've ever seen what spent fuel looks like after it's been irradiated in a reactor, first of all, there are gases that are generated that are inside the fuel rod. Second of all, it becomes very heavily cracked and even pulverized. So it's not quite as solid as Paul would make it sound like. But to address Yucca Mountain, we do need a long-term geologic repository in this country. We've already generated about 60,000 metric tons of spent fuel. It's not the volume that's the major consideration. It's the content, long-lived radioactive materials that really do have to be isolated from the environment for a very long time because they are radiotoxic. And right now, the Obama administration has canceled the only project we had for a geologic repository, which was the Yucca Mountain Project. Now, that project had a lot of problems. There were technical issues, and it was bitterly opposed by the state that was supposed to host it. So we need a process for siting a new repository that can deal with both the technical and the political concerns. And so, of course, that's a very difficult thing to do.
Paul Wilson, Edwin says this is not about volume. It's about content. And when it comes to the fact that the U.S. simply can't agree on a large-scale nuclear waste dump, does it suggest that the public still has problems embracing nuclear power? And is the administration getting ahead of itself on this issue?
Well, I think that it's important that the the urgency from a technical point of view really isn't necessarily there. I agree that it's a problem that the Yucca Mountain Project has been treated by the Obama administration the way that it has. It was unfortunate that the same week that President Obama made his declaration about science-based policy that he turned around the same week and announced that they'd be halting all work on the Yucca Mountain Project, which is really largely a political decision. The Yucca Mountain Project's been studied for nearly 30 years. There's a lot of evidence that it could be a viable geologic repository. Even if it's not the best choice, I think it would be important to demonstrate that it is a safe and adequate choice, and we should be moving forward with that. As to the public opinion on spent nuclear fuel and repositories, I think we've seen other countries, most recently Sweden, be very successful in a very different public process. And I think that's what Ed was referring to, is that we need to take a new look at the public process we have for determining the potential locations for geologic repositories, explore processes like have been done in other countries with much more public engagement from the beginning, and find communities and locations that are more willing to host these. I think that it's when the right community is going to find it to be a benefit to their community in the long term rather than a detriment.
I'll get to that in the next block. I'd like to go to another call here first from Augusta, Georgia. Jerome is on the line. Hi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Quick background. I'm an electrical engineer. Mm-hmm. I've been an engineer for 25 years. 12 of those 25 years, I worked at the plant site here outside of Augusta, Georgia. I'm trying to give everybody a visual. Number one, to get into the plants, you got to go through so much security. You got to go through a bomb sniffer, metal detector, just to get to your desk. Another thing, I've been in the plant at 100% power. I've been in containment at 100% power. I've done design change. And I don't understand this whole safety and security issue that everybody has problems with.
What about the issue of waste, Jerome? If security is not an issue, what about the issue of waste and where it goes?
Yes, ma'am. And the way, what we have now, we have a spent fuel pool. So after we're going through a refueling outage, we take part of that fuel and we put it in the spent fuel pool, keep it underwater, and we have a cooling system to keep it cool. We have enough storage to keep it there for about 20-plus years to do that. And I just wanted to listen, let your audience know it's not what everybody thinks. If you take any other industry, a chemical industry, and adopt the rules and regulations that we have to follow from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they can never pass. If you mess up with a procedure or design change, it goes through so many steps to even get it implemented. And so I don't understand. You have to really be, quote unquote, on point when you are doing your job at a nuke plant.
Jerome, thank you. I appreciate your call. I appreciate it very much. Edwin Lyman, would you respond?
First of all, I'd like to say that I think that nuclear plant workers, by and large, are a very diligent and trustworthy group of people, and we have no problem with them. The issue does have to do with management largely and regulation, and the fact that when complacency sets in, that is when there's a problem. When management refuses to look at indicators that there's a problem in the plant, there can be what are called safety culture issues, which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is starting to appreciate. The worst case of this was at the Davis-Bessey plant in Ohio, where there was a systemic failure on the part of the managers, the regulators, and some of the staff to ignore warning signs that there was significant corrosion going on in the reactor vessel. And we came within a few months of another Three Mile Island at that plant because of this failure. And that is the kind of thing we have to avoid. So we mustn't remain complacent. You have to remain vigilant.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the big push for more nuclear power in this country. Edwin Lyman joins me from Washington this hour. He's senior scientist and physicist for global security for the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Paul Wilson joins me from Madison, Wisconsin. He's professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here's President Obama on Tuesday emphasizing that in order to keep up with the rest of the world, the United States must invest in more nuclear power.
Our competitors are racing to create jobs and command growing energy industries. and nuclear energy is no exception. Japan and France have long invested heavily in this industry. Meanwhile, there are 56 nuclear reactors under construction around the world, 21 in China alone, 6 in South Korea, 5 in India. And the commitment of these countries is not just generating the jobs in those plants, it's generating demand for expertise and new technologies.
Paul Wilson, what are the differences between the industries of France and China and the United States?
So the technologies are very similar, and I think, in fact, China is using American and French technology right now to build their nuclear reactors. But the industries, you know, I think the biggest difference is the degree of involvement from the government and the ability of the government to impose an energy policy. What we see in France and China is, to different degrees, China more so than France, that the government can choose an energy policy, set a direction, and has a strong degree of influence over how that plays out. That doesn't happen in the United States, and for a lot of reasons we're maybe thankful for that. But I think that what we have instead then is the United States is left with a very difficult time imposing an energy policy as such, even if they were able to articulate one. And they're left doing it through measures such as environmental policy, security policy, and economic policy.
Edwin Lyman, what is the lesson to your mind of how Europe has relied on nuclear power and what they've learned? What has been their experience?
Well, let's take France in particular. A lot of people like to point to France and claim that's something that the United States should be modeling our own energy system after. But the French actually, I think, may be regretting the fact that 80% of their electricity comes from nuclear power. That is simply too much baseload electricity from a single source. And as a result, sometimes they have to shut their plants down on weekends when demand is low. That is not a good strategy for operating a nuclear plant. The other problem with France is that they pursue a technology with their waste known as reprocessing. And reprocessing actually extracts plutonium from spent fuel. Plutonium is a material that can be used in nuclear weapons. And they ended up generating a large stockpile of plutonium, which is just sitting in storage, which has to be protected at great expense. They only reuse a fraction of that as new fuel. And that is not a strategy that the United States should be should actually try to model because of the proliferation terrorism risks associated with separated plutonium.
Let me go to a call here on this particular point from South Burlington, Vermont. Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I've got a question. It's been mentioned that it's been 30 years since a nuclear reactor was built in the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And someone was just talking about France there. And I saw a recent article in The Economist magazine that the French nuclear reactor company Areva undertook to build a reactor for Finland, and that at last count the project was over time and approximately $2.5 billion over budget. If the last project in the United States is more than 30 years ago, who is there who has experience in managing such a project, and can we expect such kinds of cost overruns, and if so, is that just part of the cost of doing business, of getting the industry going again?
Bill, thank you very much. Edwin Lyman?
Well, I do think that the Areva's experience in Finland is causing a lot of consternation in the nuclear industry. The plant is significantly over budget and may be delayed more than 3 years. The fact is it is the first of a kind, and that design actually has some unique features which add to the cost and complexity. But I think we do have to expect that the first number of nuclear plants that are built in this country, if they are built, are going to experience similar cost overruns. And this is why the United States government is asking taxpayers to essentially shoulder a lot of the risk of default for these projects, because they are simply not going to attract private financing given the experience of Areva in Finland and elsewhere.
Why shouldn't we expect some sort of government bailout to Edwin's point in the future, Paul Wilson?
I'm not sure. So I think that we need the...
Well, as far as the cost of these projects.
Well, I think the government is really doing a great degree of due diligence to investigate whether or not these are the best place to be supporting these loans. There's a lot of different applications for nuclear reactors have applied for this loan guarantees. The government ranked them all based on a lot of different factors, including how ready they were to begin operation or begin construction. their financial package, the way this risk is being spread through different partners. The operation in Southern Company, the one that was just awarded earlier this week, has some very experienced architect and engineer firms who are going to be involved in that construction process. To speak to your last caller, who wanted to know about how it's been 30 years since we built one. Do we know how to do this? Well, we have large construction operations which do go on in the United States all the time, and we have those companies involved in these processes to make sure that we do have the experience for this construction. So I think that the government is really putting a lot of analysis, external analysis, internal analysis, into these decisions, and they're also requiring the utilities to pay administrative fees and some almost like insurance fees for the administration of this program to really hedge against that possibility of default in the future. And finally, in the long term, these plants will be built and will be operated if they go forward, and will eventually recover that money. And so even if there is a default, it's very unlikely that the taxpayer in the long term is going to be out that money.
Here's another call from Boston. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Jane. How you doing?
Hi. Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I was trained by the Navy as a nuclear operator, and I've operated nuclear reactors by the time I was 21. And I guess my question is why is it that, we're not making a big deal about the Navy operating and building these nuclear reactors? And in fact, we've been building these nuclear reactors since the very beginning. And the Navy has never had an incident of discharging nuclear waste or having any problem with that. And they're not even actually under the NRC. They have their own naval reactors that they're under.
Good point, Steve. Thank you. Edwin Lyman, would you respond?
Well, I don't think the Navy is really a good model to understand the commercial nuclear industry in this country. We don't have Admiral Rickover, who was an extremely exacting taskmaster and essentially designed the nuclear Navy to be fail-safe. Unfortunately, the Navy isn't. The commercial industry has commercial pressures that the Navy is largely exempt from, and it's those commercial pressures that will always lead to the temptation to cut corners, and that's where the largest risk comes from.
Robert is now calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just wondering when the nuclear energy went downhill in the 70s and the 80s, there was a lot of talk about the reason they were so expensive was that they're very high-temperature, high-pressure reactors, which take very exotic materials and corrosion and all that, and there was talk of making lower pressure, lower temperature, more cookie-cutter reactors that then make their steam and go to a turbine somewhere. But instead of having one huge mammoth thing, have a more like using a Bath Iron Works type of facility to make a lot smaller, but and putting them together at one site to get the energy you need to run the big turbine. And I'm wondering if that has any is happening in the future or now, or any thought?
Simpler, cheaper reactors, are those on the horizon? Paul Wilson.
So I think there's a couple of different paths that the caller alluded to. One is that the next round of reactors that we're going to see built in this country are much simpler. They're still very large. They're still high temperature, high pressure. But they're much simpler systems that are much more fail-safe. They operate much more on natural forces to provide their safety. But the caller was also alluding to the idea of small reactors. And we have half a dozen companies in the country now that are designing new reactors that are smaller reactors, as well as others overseas. And there's a lot of interest right now in smaller reactors that might be better suited to different markets. It's not clear to me whether they're going to be a big panacea for the domestic market. We have a lot of experience with large reactors. We have a strong regulatory experience with large reactors. And so we have to see how they're going to fit. They need to be able to be produced in such quantities in a factory-like environment for them to pay off and become economical compared to the large reactors. But I think there's a lot of hope that we can do that. It's just really about a volume.
Edward Lyman, what do you think of a simpler, cheaper, smaller reactor?
Well, to address the small modular reactors, it's actually not true that there's interest among utilities in this country in smaller reactors. The trend has been to go to larger and larger reactors to get economies of scale. Now, I have some concerns about the proposals for small reactors, mainly because the vendors do not want to put them under robust containment. They claim that because they're smaller, you don't have to worry as much about a radiation release. Unfortunately, even a small reactor is going to have a very large radioactive inventory, and I don't think it's appropriate not to have containment for those plants. On what Paul said about the next generation being simpler and safer, my analysis indicates that actually isn't the case. The fact is that there are larger uncertainties associated with the operation of some of the designs like the AP1000 that are being proposed in how it would actually function in a severe accident. And those uncertainties really cloud the picture of whether or not they're going to be safer.
Paul Wilson, I'll let you quickly respond.
So I think on both issues, on the small reactors, you know, just today we have a story in the Wall Street Journal that the three large utilities are interested in small reactors. They're going to help Babcock and Wilcox get commercial licensing for their new reactor design, which is a much smaller design. As for the complexity of these new reactors, I think one of the differences that we see in this next round of reactors is the licensing process has changed so that the uncertainty in the licensing has been pushed off to the very beginning. And so the concerns that Ed sees with the safety of these new designs, we're seeing it because we have a rigorous design review process that's going on right now. The AP1000 that Southern Company would like to build is being investigated as a paper design with volumes and volumes and volumes of analysis to ensure that the regulator believes that it will operate safely before they start building the reactor. And this is a very important change that's happened in the last 20 years. And one of the reasons why we have uncertainty in the licensing process is because it's never happened before. And so we're maybe uncovering these issues, and we're working hard to make sure that they're all resolved. But before we start building the reactor, they will be resolved, and we'll have a certified design that the regulator feels can be operated and built safely.
Here's another call from Ithaca, New York. Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Jane. Yes, Chris from sunny Ithaca. The question I have has to do with health issues. In the downwind area of the Indian Island plant on the Hudson River, in the Fairfield County towns, there's twice the rate of child and infant cancer than the other towns in Connecticut. This happened after, of course, it was installed, and fortunately after I was a youth in that part. So what are the downwind problems? Over.
Good question, Chris. Thank you very much. Paul Wilson, would you begin?
So I'm not familiar with the specific example. My experience, however, has been that in most cases, a careful statistical study of these kind of findings finds that there's really not a statistical difference based only on the fact that it's near a nuclear power plant. You can find cancer clusters. You can find higher occurrences of different kinds of cancers in lots of different places that are completely independent from the proximity to a nuclear power plant. I can't speak to this particular one. I'm not familiar with the findings here. But I think it's difficult to draw a really strong conclusion about these downwind issues just from looking at one population, anecdotal evidence in one population.
What are your conclusions, Edwin Lyman, with regard to health issues?
Yeah, again, my concerns are more toward the possibility of a catastrophic accident. I've actually looked at Indian Point. It's only 25 miles from the New York metropolitan area. And if there were a terrorist attack or a large radiological release at that plant, it could potentially cause hundreds of thousands of cancer deaths in the New York City area. And so that plant needs particular attention, and it's not getting it.
Here's Karen.
So Jane, can I just respond?
Oh, sure, Paul.
Quickly?
Go ahead.
You know, I think it's easy to point out this concern for these catastrophic accidents. However, it's very difficult, and our engineers and our scientists are studying it. It's very difficult to identify a pathway of where you go from a safely operating reactor to this imagined catastrophic accident. We do analysis after analysis, and we just don't see it happening. We think things like Three Mile Island happened, and from a public health point of view, that was not a catastrophic accident. It was not a Chernobyl. It was a financial accident for the company that owned the reactor. But we just can't see how we get from the place where we're operating
Paul,
a reactor safely.
Well, when you calculate the core damage frequency and the large early release frequency, what are the values you get for current plants? It's about 1 in 10,000 per year for core damage. And
it's about 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 50,000
for large release.
And core damage frequency doesn't mean large catastrophic accident with public health impacts. Core damage
it
frequency
means
is
core
very
melt.
Different.
And
yeah, but
so
core melt, we had core melt in Three Mile Island. We did not have large public health impacts from radiological release.
As we head into the final minute here of our broadcast, I'm just curious what you think, both of you, that the chances of this particular nuclear power plant that we're talking about proposed for Georgia, what do you think the chances are that it will actually happen? Edward Lyman?
Well, because the regulatory environment is very favorable in the state of Georgia, from a financial perspective, it's probably more viable than other plants. But I do remain concerned about the reactor design. Westinghouse, which designed the AP1000, sabotaged its own design by redesigning the shield building that's supposed to protect the plant from aircraft, from high winds, from tornadoes. And they actually jeopardized the design certification they already had, throwing a monkey wrench in the works of the approval process. So right now, I don't think anyone knows whether that design can be modified appropriately in a reasonable period of time. So I think that causes a great deal of risk for that project.
And Paul Wilson, you get the final word about this project.
So I think that it will go forward for a lot of the reasons that Dr. Lyman just described. The regulatory environment from the Public Utility Commission there in Georgia is favorable. I think we've got the risk diversified and spread among many different parties. And the AP1000 design is moving forward. And frankly, I'm happy that there's organizations like UCS who are concerned about safety, because they're going to help ensure that we have a public confidence in the regulator, so that when we have this plant get built in the next, within the next decade, that the public will be confident that it's a safe design in the end.
Well, I want to thank our panelists for a very in-depth conversation today. Edwin Lyman was the Union of Concerned Scientists. I appreciate your joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
And Paul Wilson of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I appreciate your time as well. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.